Well, welcome to the 101st day of the year, 14th week of the year, first week of this series called Old Men and Women. We're going to spend the next couple of months, as Fee said, looking at a bunch of different characters from the Old Testament. That's the reason for the old. It's not because they happen to be old in the stories that they feature, but they're all from the Old Testament. And they're not always shining examples to us. Sometimes they're warning signs for maybe what we shouldn't do rather than what we should do. But over and above their questionable character, I think we will continue to discover that God is sovereign in his desire to bring about his plan through us and through them. And perhaps this morning's character, Samson, there's no greater example of that, of a guy who doesn't always do as God would love him to do, but yet God uses him to bring about his plans. So I feel as though this morning should begin with a couple of warnings. One is that it's a bit graphic on occasions. It's an Old Testament story, so there's a bit of blood and gore. And the other is that it might mess with your idea of how God operates sometimes, and that's not a bad thing for us to face every now and then. I think the truth that we'll keep circling back to is that God consistently uses imperfect people. And if all he had to work with is perfect people, he would have a sample of one, his son Jesus. And it is true absolutely that he does his most world-changing, eternity-altering work through Jesus, but he also uses frail vessels like you and me to do his work, which is good news, right? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, he wouldn't be able to use us at all. So, let's get moving. I've titled this morning, Big Hair, Bigger God, Bigger Jesus. And I've got props galore, okay? Good morning for props. Here's my first prop for the big hair. I'll see how long I can keep this on, okay? There's one side of this that's got a fringe and the others don't. So, here we go. You might want to start by telling me everything you know about Samson. Is this the fringe side?
Yep.
He had big hair. Yeah. He did?
Strong.
Strong? Yep. Anything else?
A real bookhead.
He what?
A real bookhead.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, in preparation for this morning, I took a Nazarite vow, and we're going to get to the Nazarite vow in a moment because this is the way that Samson was raised, but I want to walk through Samson's story to paint a picture of him, kind of how the text presents it, but then to kind of unpack some of that because it's not necessarily true all the way through. And as I've started digging, I've seen that Samson is often viewed as either a model of failure or like a one-dimensional cardboard cutout cartoon type figure. And so some present his life like this motivational poster, which I particularly like. Mistakes. It could be that the purpose of your life is only to serve as a warning to others, which I love as one of those motivational posters. And so Samson is often held up as a warning wreck for the dangers of lust. That's one version of him. And the other is this cartoon-like depiction of this strongman Samson who can bust out of ropes anytime he wants, but he has this form of kryptonite called hair. And so before we begin, I want to burst some of that superhero bubble and some of the super failure bubble by getting you to turn to Hebrews chapter 11. Now this chapter is often referred to as the faith Hall of Fame, and it runs through in Hebrews this catalogue of men and women who showed incredible faith to bring about God's salvation plan. And if you go down to verse 32, you will read this: "What more shall I say?" 11:32. "I do not have time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, and Jephthah, about David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Now, almost all of those things that are said at the end, verses 33 and 34, apply to Samson. There's definitely three or four that do for sure. But one thing that ultimately is true is that Samson has something that God wants in all of us, and that's faith. We'll get there. Okay, turn to Judges 13. Maybe the first person who's there can yell out a page number. Judges chapter 13. And as you're getting there, let me give you a bit of preamble. When God delivers... When God delivers the Israelites... Excellent.
Oh, thank you.
When God delivers the Israelites from Egypt, he delivers them to the promised land, and they don't have an earthly king straight away. Yahweh is meant to be their king. And instead, there is a succession of judges who don't rule over them, but walk with them and lead them. But Yahweh is meant to be their king. Now, that doesn't work out so well for the Israelites because they continue to rebel against God and turn their back on him. And in fact, a phrase that goes through Judges a fair bit, and also 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles, is Israel had no king, and the people did as they saw fit. Basically, the Israelites turned rogue. And as a result of their disobedience and their refusal to listen to God, God would occasionally hand them over to one of the warring neighbourhood countries. And when they realised that they'd done a stupid thing, they turned their back on God, then God would raise up another judge to save them and to lead them. And often it was because the Israelites came to their senses and they cried out to God. They repented and said, "Woe is us, help us, help us." And God helps them. As a result of their disobedience and refusal to listen to God, this is the story of Samson. Now, so far, before we get to chapter 13, this has happened 11 times. 11 times they turned their back on God. 11 times God has raised up another judge to rule over them. And when it gets to Judges 13, it seems as though they don't even call out anymore. But God realizes that they need a rescuer, a savior. And so I thought about this, and I thought, this, we look at this pattern for Israel and we're like, well, that's ridiculous, how silly of them. But it's often our pattern as well. And sometimes I think in the Old Testament, the condensed timeline makes it more stark how great the disobedience is. But often that disobedience for us is just as true, that things are going okay. We start to feel as though we've got life sorted, everything's going as we planned, and your self-reliance goes up, and your God reliance comes down, and your relationship with God becomes a bit scant, and you start believing that you can do all things through you who strengthens you. Mm-hmm. And it's all good until it's not. And disaster strikes, and suddenly you either cry out to God or you blame him for the mess that you're in, this God that you've abandoned. And either way, you may run back to God. You say, I'm sorry what I've turned this into. I need you. I repent. I come back to you. And you remember a verse like, "God is my light and my salvation. In whom shall I fear? God is the stronghold of my days. In whom shall I be afraid?" And you go, "This time I'm standing. I'm staying true." And things start to go okay for a while. And then your reliance on God comes down. And so the cycle keeps on going. Now, that mightn't be you, but it's definitely been me sometimes. Now, all of that gets us to the beginning of Judges 13. They've abandoned God again. God has handed them over to the Philistines for 40 years. And God makes another rescue mission to save Israel, get his salvation plan back on track, and that will turn out to be Samson. Now, do you know anyone else who was raised up to be a salvation plan for Israel?
Jesus.
Good answer. Safe answer. I have to say, it made me wonder when I was looking through this that in all of these occasions when they are again under a form of bondage to another nation, were they continuing to celebrate Passovers together? Were they having feasts together? And did they sit down at these Passover feasts and go, "Remember that time when we were in slavery and God released us and he gave us a mighty victory and he delivered us out of our chains of slavery and let us celebrate the Passover lamb, and let us remember how he set us free, all the while forgetting that they've just done it again and they're in bondage. So they continue to do this ritual without realising that God hasn't forgotten them. God's wanting them to cry out to them, but they've forgotten. And then that made me wonder whether it's possible that sometimes we sit down and we grab a piece of bread and remember God's body broken for us, that a price was paid for us, that we take this wine and we go, thank God for this new covenant that's made in Jesus, that we're adopted into his family, that we're sons and daughters of God, and yet we remain slaves to sin and fearful of death. So these symbols are meant to be reminders of our freedom. And the Israelites forgot, we forget too. So again, I said the tale of the Israelites is pretty stark in Judges, and it's kind of a bit easy, I reckon, to go, how embarrassing that they let that happen. But we are all capable of our own nuanced brand of amnesia and pride and forgetfulness and disobedience and our self-reliance. And we see with the Israelites where that gets them. It often gets us to similar places. But God delivers them anyway. Not only when they know they need a rescuer, but when they don't and he does. Which is like us. Paul writes, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. God delivered the great deliverer for us so that we can go free. Okay, so let's keep on tracking. We're going to go straight through the entire story, which starts at 13. So they're in captivity. They're there for 40 years, and there's a man called Manoah, and his wife is out in the field, and an angel appears to his wife and says, you're barren. I know that you're barren. You were never going to have a child, but I'm going to gift you with a son. And she's very excited. She gives him, the angel gives her some guidelines and says, for the term of your pregnancy, you are to have no wine at all, no fermented drink, and you're not to eat anything that's unclean. How would you have gone with that, Fee?
Yeah.
But he says, the angel says, you'll become pregnant, you'll have a son whose head is never to be touched by a razor, because the boy is to be a Nazarite, dedicated to God from the womb. Now, a little bit about Nazarite vow. Nazir is a word that is a Hebrew word that means set apart, dedicated, consecrated. And so it was a vow that either was taken in the short term, or sometimes in the case of Samson and Samuel and probably John the Baptist, taken by their parents on the child's behalf to set apart this child, usually from God's instruction. And you can read about it in Numbers 6. There are three main elements to the Nazarite vow. One is no wine, no grape products, no fermented drinks, no vinegar that came from grapes.
No kombucha.
No touching of dead bodies. Got a good story about that bone, but anyway. And the final one is no razor to touch the head. And these are kind of the main three. Now, in the New Testament, there's... can I tell you the story about this bone?
Is so that just hair little... from a week?
Yes. Yeah, certainly not from my head.
I thought it was
just last night, got a little lock from my hair. No, I'll tell you about the bone later.
Okay.
So they're the three main elements. In the New Testament, it seems as though people take short-term Nazarite vows as a way of consecrating themselves, a little bit like we might with Lent. And Paul, at one point, it says after he had finished this ritual time, he had his hair cut again, which seems to indicate that he might have taken a Nazarite vow. So it can be volitional, and it's just for a time to set yourself apart, to devote yourself to what God's doing. Doesn't mean that you're not doing that aside from the Nazarite vow, but it's a really intentional time. So Manoah's wife hears this, goes back, tells her husband. The husband, Manoah's wife's never named, by the way, a bit disappointing. But Manoah says, well, I'd love to hear this again from whoever it was that you spoke to. So Manoah's wife is again in the field. The angel appears again, and Manoah's wife says to the angel, just give me a few minutes while I get my husband, if you can just wait for a moment. Goes and gets Manoah. Manoah comes back, and Manoah says, tell us the story again. He says, your wife isn't to have any grape derivatives, and you're not to use a razor on your son's head. And they go, right, we can do that. Manoah says, would you like a meal? And the angel says, I don't really eat. And so, but what you could do is make a sacrifice. At this stage, they don't really realize that it's an angel at all. Mm. But they make the sacrifice. And as they're making the sacrifice, the flames go up and the angel goes up in the flames as well. And they realize that it was an angel and they fall down and they go, oh dear, we're done for. And then Manoah's wife goes, actually, maybe we're not, because we're doing what he told us to do, and it looks as though we might be blessed with a son. And they are blessed with a son, and they call him Samson, which means like the sun, or strong, or distinguished. That's chapter 13. Chapter 14. So, last verse of chapter 13 is, and the Spirit of the Lord began to stir in Samson. Very next verse says, Samson went down to Timnah and saw there a young Philistine woman. So his spirit begins to stir in Samson, and somehow, strangely, his first reaction is, I'm going to go to the Philistines who are unclean, who are not my people, who he would have known by then are the uncircumcised ones, but he goes there anyway. And he returns to mum and dad and he says, I've seen a Philistine woman in Timnah, verse 2. Now go and get her so she can be my wife. Now she's never named either. She is given a name, but we'll get there later on. And his mum and dad gently push back and say, is there maybe like someone appropriate from the chosen people of Israel who is from the circumcision? And his reply to the dad is, get her for me. She's the right one.
In my eyes.
Yep. And I think that chapter 14, verse 4, is a really significant verse in the whole story of Samson. It says, his parents did not know that this was from the Lord, who was seeking an occasion to confront the Philistines, for at that time they were ruling over Israel. And I put in my Bible, just in brackets, nor did Samson. It's not as though Samson knew the grand plan of God or it had been a revelation to him. Mm-hmm. Samson was just acting from his flesh, sees a girl that he decides he likes, and goes, that one. Gets his mum and dad to go and secure her for him. And it's not as though he is actively participating in God's plan. It's more that God is working a plan despite Samson. Mm-hmm. So, Samson then goes down to Timnah with his parents, and he's walking separate to his parents when a mighty lion, says young, comes up, rushes towards him, and Samson rips open the jaws of the lion and destroys the lion as though it was a goat, and leaves the lion in tatters, doesn't tell his mum and dad about this, goes down, talks to the woman, and it says in verse 7, he liked her, which I think is subtle Old Testament nuance there. It's like totally besotted by this woman. And sometime later, it says that he went back to marry her. And he turned aside as he was going and he looked at the lion's carcass. Lion's carcass, does this tell anything, say anything to you? Lion's carcass? No?
Oh, touching dead animals.
Yes, boom.
Oh.
And he sees that inside the lion's carcass is this fresh honey. And he grabs some honey and he takes of the honey and he enjoys it, gives some to his parents, doesn't tell them where it comes from, but gives it to them, scoops it out of the lion. And then he goes down to see the woman. And then there is this almighty feast, which is an almighty drinking party that is customary for young men, it says. They gather 30 partygoers for Samson. And there is this 7-day feast, which is basically a drinking fest. Anything going on with the drinking fest? Lucky my phone is waterproof. And so at the beginning of this drinking fest, he says to the men that are gathered there, I'm going to tell you a riddle, and you need to see if you can figure out what this riddle means. Because Samson is a tricky trickster. You're going to see this as we go along in the story. And the riddle is this: out of the eater, something to eat; out of the strong, something sweet. And so these guys, they're trying to figure out, what does this riddle mean? And they can't figure it out, and after 3 days, they go to Samson's wife, and they basically say, you need to figure out what this riddle is, you need to go to Samson. And so Samson's wife goes sobbing to Samson, and says, you hate me, you don't really love me. If you really love me, you'd give me the answer to this riddle so I wouldn't look silly. And Samson's response is, I haven't even told it to mummy or daddy yet. And so, look, there's some obvious leaving and cleaving problems here, because Samson is still more devoted to what's going on with mum and dad, and Samson's wife is still more devoted to the people that she comes from than either of them are to each other. So he gives her the answer all the same, probably because of her nagging. And then on the seventh day, the guys come back, and they have now the answer to the riddle. And the answer to the riddle is, what is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? And Samson says, and here's where the wife gets named, if you had not ploughed with my heifer — heifer is an old cow — if you had not ploughed with my old cow, you would not have solved my riddle. Samson is a great respecter of women.
Wow.
And as a result of this, Samson gets angry, and he needs to come up with the price of the riddle. Now, the price of the riddle that Samson had given was 30 new sets of clothes for himself. So now he needs to find 30 new sets of clothes. He doesn't have them. So he's now lost the riddle, thanks to the old heifer. And he goes down and he takes out 30 men and strips them of their clothes and gives them to the 30 companions. Story's going pretty well so far. It gets better, because Samson then leaves and goes back to daddy, and Samson's wife's dad gives the wife to Samson's best man. Okay? Story's going pretty well so far. Samson's back at home.
Yeah.
Okay, now, chapter 15, a bit later on, Samson decides that he doesn't mind his wife so much after all. Thinks, I'm going to go back to my wife. When he gets back to there, the father of the wife says, oh, I thought you hated her, so I gave her to your best man. But if you like, I've got this other daughter, you can have her. And Samson gets really angry this time. Now, if you ever feel the need to get even with someone, but you're out of ideas for how to get retribution, here's an idea. Verse 4 of chapter 15. He went out and he caught 300 foxes, and he tied their tails together in pairs, and then he fastened a torch to every pair of tails, and then he let the foxes loose. Now, they're tied to each other, so they're mounted as cut snakes, and they go with these torches, and all the fields are set on fire, all the vineyards, all the crops, and they all burn down. And the Philistines say, who did this? And they say, well, it was Samson, the Timnite son-in-law, because the father gave Samson's wife to his best man. And so now they're angry at the father and Samson's wife, and so they burn them to death.
Oh.
Not a good end to the story. It's a little ironic, because earlier on, back in chapter 14, verse 15, the wife has said, the Philistines have said, you need to get your husband to tell us the answer. If you don't, we'll burn you to death. She ends up getting burnt to death anyway. So Samson then goes off, hides in a cave for a while, and the Philistines come after him. Instead, they go to the people of Judah, who are in fear of the Philistines, and they say, we're going to stop from attacking you if you will deliver Samson to us. So they come to them, 3,000 of them, to subdue Samson. And they tie up Samson, and Samson says, "Don't kill me." They said, "We're not going to kill you. We want to petition you to hand yourself over to the Philistines." And he goes, "Yeah, okay." So he hands them over. They hand him over as he's getting close to the Philistines. They rush towards him, and Samson busts out of the ropes that they've put around him, and he picks up the jawbone of a donkey. And with that jawbone, he slays 1,000 men. Pretty wild man. And he comes up with this pithy rhyme after taking them all out with this jawbone. And the pithy rhyme is, "With a donkey's jawbone, I have made donkeys of them. With a donkey's jawbone, I have killed 1,000 men." Now, it's pithy because it turns out the Hebrew word for donkey sounds almost exactly the same as the Hebrew word for a pile of dead bodies. So, "With the donkey's jawbone, I have made donkeys, a pile of dead bodies of them. With the donkey's jawbone, I killed 1,000 men." And when he finishes speaking, he says, "Thank you for this victory, God. I'm now really thirsty." He gets a drink. And then we move to chapter 16, which is where Delilah enters the story. Now, Delilah gets a name. That's a bit of an advancement on the heifer. But before Samson gets to be besotted by Delilah, he has a short-term fling with a prostitute just to reinforce his power over his flesh and how subdued he is. Samson has a weakness, should be obvious by now, and it's women. People of Gaza says, "Samson is here. We've heard that he's spending time with a prostitute. Now might be our moment to subdue him." But Samson busts out of the city and escapes, and then he comes sniveling back again, and this is the time that he meets Delilah, and he seems to be totally besotted by Delilah. He falls in love with her, and there's no evidence in the story that that love is reciprocal. Doesn't seem at all that Delilah loves him back. But a bunch of Philistines approach Delilah and say to her, "See if you can lure Samson into revealing the source of his strength so we can take him out. And if you do, we will give you 1,100 shekels of silver." It's about 15 years of wages. It's a big bounty that's given to him, to her, as an incentive. So Delilah says to Samson, "Tell me your secret." And there's then this bit of a game that seems to go on between Samson the tricky trickster and Delilah, where he says, "Sure, I'll tell you. If you tie me up with 7 fresh bowstrings, I'll become as weak as any other man." So they do that, and he busts out, no problem at all. And Delilah goes back to Samson and went, "That was a little bit unfair. You told me this, now I look a bit silly." And he says, "Oh yeah, look, if you go with new ropes, that'll definitely work." So they do that, doesn't work either. He busts out of them. Third time, she says, "You've been making a fool of me. Why'd you do that?" He says, this time, which I reckon is starting to get a bit closer to the edge, "If you weave the seven braids of my head into the fabric of the loom and tighten it, I'll become as weak as any other man." He goes to sleep. They do this, but he rips that apart. And then finally, it says, "I can't believe you've done this to me. How can you say I love you when you won't confide in me? This is the third time you've made a fool of me." With such nagging, she prodded him day after day until he was sick to death of it. And he told her everything. "No razor has been used against my head. I've been brought up with a Nazarite vow. The hair of my head is touched. I will become as weak as any other man." Delilah lets the Philistines know. One of the Philistines comes while he is asleep, cuts his hair, and then Delilah calls out, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you. He says, "I'll go out there and I'll fight just like I have every other time." But this time, his strength is gone. The Philistines seize him, they gouge his eyes out, and they put him in prison, And there's this sad picture where it says that they set him to grinding grain in the prison, which is usually the job of
the
what?
Donkey.
A donkey, yeah. So they make a donkey of him. And then later on, the rulers of the Philistines come to celebrate their capture of Samson. And they all gather in the temple of Dagon. And Dagon is the god that they're going to credit with delivering Samson to them. And 3,000 of the most important people in the Philistine nation are all there. And they bring Samson out, blind Samson, to entertain them by dancing for them. And Samson says, "Can you just position me between these two pillars, which happens to support the temple, so that I can..." By the way, we missed the moment when this happened.
Yeah.
So that I can just have my bearings for what's going on. And as he is doing that and being made sport and being mocked, he cries out to God and he says, "Sovereign Lord, remember me. Please, God, strengthen me just one more time and let me..." It's a sad part of the story, but I've skipped the saddest part. "Strengthen me once more so that I can get revenge for their actions towards me." Now bear in mind, going back to 14 verse 4, his parents did not know that this was from the Lord, who was seeking an occasion to confront the Philistines. This is that moment. And bracing himself against these temple pillars, he puts his hands on them. He says, "Let me die with the Philistines." And he pushed, and the entire temple collapses on them. And it says, "Thus he killed many more when he died than when he lived." He led the Israelites for 20 years. Now, I find that last bit pretty interesting, because either Samson was a bivocational judge, or he was an absent lover, or I don't know when he was moonlighting as a judge, but he was embedded within the Philistines and somehow judging the Israelites as well. Anyway, five thoughts as we pull this all together. Big story, right?
Mm.
Big story. The first is that Samson is extraordinarily gifted by God.
Mm.
Okay? Extraordinarily gifted. He's given supernatural strength, so he's able to fulfill God's purposes for him. But it doesn't make him the perfect specimen at all. He is flawed. He's way flawed. And I think that sometimes we can have the tendency to expect that anyone who is gifted by God in a particular area should be perfect across the board. And often we're disappointed when we discover that they're not, that they are frail, that only Jesus can accomplish that holiness within us. But without him, we are thoroughly imperfect. We're only made perfect through our dependence on his grace. But Samson is willful, he's undisciplined, he's spoiled, he's impure, and he's a womanizer. And there's no doubt, as you read the story of Samson, that the capital city of Samson's world is Samson. He acts on his own behalf, for himself, for his desires, and his decisions are driven by those desires. Life lesson: use your strengths for God's glory, not your own. Next point. The story of Samson is not in the Bible for us to idolize his physical strength, but it's to point us ahead to the ultimate deliverer, Jesus, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, Paul writes, but made himself humble to the point of being like one of us. And being in very nature God, he was made in human likeness, found in appearance as a man, humbled, became obedient to death, even death on a cross. The capital city of Jesus' world was the Father's glory, was the Father's joy. And God's purposes in his only Son was to rescue you and me. Samson's story of disobedience and his weakness and his infidelity, I think, is blind to what God is doing through him. He's oblivious to it. God's doing stuff around him, through him. He's going to rescue the Israelites through him. But Samson is oblivious to that. And it reminded me again of that motivational poster that I started out with. And a good question I found myself asking was, would I rather achieve God's purposes through my willful disobedience of him, or through my humble submission of him and my understanding that he is using me for his glory? And I want to be the second one. I want to know about it because I'm seeking to serve him and humble myself before him, rather than being completely oblivious and God is using me. Samson's lustful, driven disobedience lands him in a place where ultimately he can't even see right from wrong. And I think while there are parts of Samson's story that we will get to that can inspire us, being self-absorbed absolutely isn't one of them. It's what Samson does once he has experienced profound failure that can be instructive for us. And one of the life lessons I see in Samson is you are not free from the consequences of your action. He reaps the consequences of his action just as we can. Third thing is that in almost every case of Samson breaking one of the Nazarite laws, there is a phrase that precedes it that I did my best to overlook as we went through it. But it's really important. And it's this phrase: then the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. Each time he breaks one of those vows, particularly in the area of dead bodies, it says, before he kills the lion, the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon Samson, and he pulled open the jaws of the lion. The Spirit of the Lord came mighty on Samson, and he killed 30 men. The Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon Samson, he took a donkey's jawbone, and he killed 1,000 men. So God empowered him with the Holy Spirit to do this. And I would say logically that would God empower him to do this and then hold him responsible for breaking a vow? And I think surely not. It's God gave him the power to break the vow, and so it seems that he is God-powered to break the vows in order to accomplish something greater, which is curious, right? And I wonder whether sometimes we can hold on to some manufactured or man-made rituals that we think are God-honouring, but God wants to bust those open to do something more powerful through us. Yeah. Just leave that one out there. The fourth thing is, which I spoke about before, there's some pretty dysfunctional relationships going on here. Whole series of them. Samson's relationship with his mum and dad seem like both weak and codependent. His parents seem to be tentative about the things that they know are right, and Samson walks all over them. His first wife doesn't even warrant the name other than old cow, and yet he continues to acquiesce to what she wants. He caves, gives her the answer to the riddle, and this ultimately will get the wife fried in flames. He has a one-night stand with a prostitute. He then is weak with Delilah, who never loves him, just uses him to get this big bounty that's on his head. And if there is a lesson here, it's choose your life partner really wisely, because your life partner can absolutely affect the trajectory of your life in really unhelpful ways, but also in supremely helpful ways. So do that with great intent. Fifth and second last one is that Samson isn't completely oblivious to the strength that God's given him. In Judges 15:5, it says that Samson cried out to the Lord, "You have given your servant a great victory." He seems to forget along the way where the real source of his strength is, but he wasn't always oblivious to it. And he knows he's strong, but he forgets that he is strong because the Spirit has made him strong. And it becomes a game to Samson. As I said before, I don't think he realises that he's signing his death warrant when he says, "If you cut my hair, that'll be the end of me." I don't think he thinks there's going to be any problem. In fact, it says in verse 20, he wakes up from his sleep and he says, "I'll go out as before and I'll shake myself free." And to me, this is the saddest verse in the whole story of Samson. It says, "But he did not know that the Lord had left him." And so he goes to do his normal thing, and he's got no strength at all because God's power has gone. Because Samson thought he was strong, not made strong by God. 1 Corinthians 10:12 says, "See to it that if you think you are standing, see to it." So if you think you are standing firm, be careful lest you fall. As in, what's your pride? Don't think that you're doing this in your own strength. Self-sufficiency might be a great idea when it comes to growing fruit and vegetables, but when it comes to your life, you want to be God-reliant, not self-reliant. And Samson believes the lie that it's about him, and it never was. I don't think that the Spirit of the Lord left Samson because of these vows. I think the Spirit of the Lord left Samson because Samson rebelled and did his own thing so many times that God said, "If that's what you want, buddy, knock yourself out." In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus, who is the only truly self-sufficient one, is the one pouring his heart out in complete dependence towards God, and is praying for help. He's sweating blood, asking for help, and the Father gives Jesus the cross so that we can have Jesus. Both Samson and Jesus hand themselves over to their oppressors. One does it knowing what God's doing. The other one does it because of his abandonment of God. But in both cases, it looks as though all is over, that the victor is a bad guy. And when it comes to Samson, they take him, they bind him, and they poke fun at him. As I said, they make him look like a donkey. And I love the end of the Samson story. And I think so often in the parody, the cartoon, we never get to the end of the story because it doesn't look like that. It looks like a blind guy who apparently is completely weak. But Samson cries out to God and he says, just one more time, strengthen me so I can have this revenge that perhaps he finally realized he was equipped for in the first place. And there's one more time, but this time it's different because he realizes he's completely weak and his only hope is complete dependence on God. He says, "Let me die with the Philistines." And the temple comes crashing down and kills Samson, but all the people that are gathered in there as well. And it says Samson killed many more when he died than when he lived, which is kind of sad, but it's also God's purpose for Samson in the first place. Life lesson: God can use bad situations to fulfill his purpose. Perhaps try in your life that you are available to him, so it's not your mistakes he's always using, but it's your willful submission to him as well. Okay, finally, final thing, wrapping it all up. I think that Samson is a paradigm for all of us, that we are richly gifted, we're richly blessed, but sometimes we play the field with our affections. We are unaware that our greatest strength is wrapped up in our greatest weakness. And so in our times of greatest weakness, God can show his greatest strength and gift to us that is given to us in Jesus. And I kept on thinking at the end of this story, Paul's words in his letter to the Corinthians, when he said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you." This is after Paul said, "Take away this thing that I'm struggling with. My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weakness, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecution, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong." It's the last moments of Samson's story when he finally puts his reliance on the source of his strength, which is God. He acknowledges that source. the biggest lesson, perhaps for me, in the godly in godly character in Samson's story is not to leave it to my last breath before going, okay, now I put all my trust in you, God. To do it now. Romans 15:4, which I reckon could be a guiding verse for every week of this series, that says, for everything that was written in the past to teach us was written to teach us, so that through endurance taught in the scriptures and the encouragement they provide, we might have hope. All these stories are to point us towards Jesus, to show us the hope that we have in Jesus, that we've been given grace upon grace upon grace in Jesus, that our gifts and our talents belong to God and have been given to us, not so that we would become self-reliant, but so that we would become God-reliant and use those gifts for His glory. And it made me think too, what gifts have we been given that we have decided, well, I'm going to use them for my glory? Or what trials or tests or temptations have we stopped fighting because we don't think that we have the strength that is sufficient to deal with them? We've forgotten that we are jars of clay to carry the all-surpassing greatness of God within us. And I think in that place there's only one thing left for us to do, and it's to do a Samson. It's to go, in our blindness, God, this time, all your strength, none of mine. All your strength, none of mine. And let this temple that I've made of my own construction come crashing down so that you can have a mighty victory. And I just want to finish by saying, look at the sort of man that God is capable of using. Philanderer. Disobedient. Vowbreaker. Self-absorbed. Faithless. This Samson who trades his God-given strength chasing after Delilah, God goes, well, here's a guy I can use. Here's a guy that might abandon himself to me. And when Samson thinks he has completely failed, is actually in the position where God goes, you're ready for me. Now we're going to do what I wanted to do through you. And that is when God accomplishes what he wanted to do. When Samson goes, you are my strength. You are the strength like no other. And that's when Samson has this mighty victory. My prayer, let's pray together, is that we put our weakness in God's hand. That God can use our weakness and turn it into the strength that only he can give. Father, I thank you for these crazy stories in your word that show these flawed people who discover in pretty brutal ways that their life was ultimately in your hands all along. Even when they were running away from you, that you're wanting to do something in them. We can take some solace in that Samson is named as this hero of the faith, and we can look at his life and go, oh man, he was sinful after sinful after sinful. And yet he turns to you at the end and says, one more time, use me for your glory. All I've got left is faith that you can do a mighty work. And that faith is regarded by you. Thanks for this story, but thank you more than everything that you give us this perfect example of the ultimate deliverer, the rock, the fortress, the one in whom we can trust, Jesus, who rescues us from our dead end and our dark dungeons and puts us in a solid, safe place in you, Lord Jesus.